Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs together on Wednesday, March 28, 2007.
And I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness.
Before we get started, we just have a quick bill to do. So I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 341. And basically, it was we had passed this bill already out of committee, and then we realized that the definitions weren't accurate. The amendment is back, and the definitions are all correct, and everyone is happy.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 341.
Senator Gorley moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 341. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 341 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley moves Senate Bill 341 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And please mark Margaret Carter as excused, and I'll carry the bill. And Vicki Walker will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 341.
And sure, I'll open the hearing on mental health community services. And we have, I think, 15 people who are scheduled to testify. We'd like to ask you to talk for 2 minutes so that give us time to ask questions, but please keep it down because we need to get all 15 and we have to leave here at 10:15, so we don't have a lot of time. So the first person would be Bob Lawrence, Chuck Frazier, and Charles Kurtz. And from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and Jim, I'm not going to have all these people. Okay. Hi. And I haven't known Charles for 40 years. It's only been, 35 years, Charles?
Senator Anderson, Representative Tomei, thank you for this invitation to discuss the geriatric mental health situation in the state of Oregon. The Governor's Commission does have a bill that we will specifically speak to when we get a committee hearing on the 11th of April. My name is Robert Lawrence, and I'm a resident of Lake Oswego, Oregon. I am currently the legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. With me today are two very, very competent people that are colleagues of mine on the Governor's Commission. Chuck Frazier is from Bend, and Charles Kurtz is from Portland. As we did our community dialogues throughout the state, the issue of mental health came up seldom in the area of geriatrics. But we went into a two-day planning session and decided that the Governor's Commission would like to emphasize the importance of geriatric mental health care in the state of Oregon. So we developed a committee, and we have developed a follow-up bill to Senate Bill 781 that was passed legislative session. With the aging population, turning our attention to developing effective treatment strategies for older Oregonians and the resources to implement these strategies is more important than ever. And at this point, I will be very brief, and I will turn this over to Chuck Frazier.
Good morning. My name is Chuck Frazier, and I am a consultant pharmacist from Bend, Oregon. I serve on the Deschutes County Mental Health Advisory Board, and I'm here today to speak as a representative of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services and tell you a little bit about what we believe you ought to be paying attention to when it comes to the community mental health system. By way of background, I am also a representing of the Community Services Work Group, which is a subcommittee that's working along with the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan Phase 2 program. I can say that high-quality community support services for the mentally ill will be essential to the success of the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. As Bob has alluded to, older adults currently comprise about 13% of the state's population. But over the next 30 years, that figure may reach 24%. Last session, the Commission proposed Bill 781, which required that community mental health programs take specific steps to address the unique needs of older adults. This bill was adopted by the legislature in the final month of the 2005 session. We see passage of this bill as an important first step to helping Oregon respond to the challenges that we will face as a result of the aging of Oregon citizens. In just a minute, my colleague Charles Kurtz will speak briefly to what we have seen in our analysis of the county mental health plans that have been developed since the passage of Senate Bill 781. But let me first speak to the work that we see remains before us. We appreciate that the report of the Community Services Work Group recognizes older adults as a special population for community support. But as yet, Oregon has limited specialized outpatient mental health programs that address the specific treatment access, engagement, and retention needs of older adult population. In an ideal situation, we would have a geriatric mental health specialist placed in each community mental health program, which would provide direct care for older adult patients and, very importantly, guide older adult patients and their families as they seek front-end and back-end services in the community care system. The cost for 33 such specialists would be approximately $6.1 million per biennium. The Commission would like to work up this investment for the 2009 to 2011 biennium, and we are proposing a modest start. Senate Bill 847, which would begin a pilot effort to establish a geriatric mental health certification program in five Oregon counties. Senate Bill 847 is a perfect fit this year, as it supports the need for geriatric mental health specialists in the near future. And now, it is my pleasure to turn to my colleague, Charles Kurtz of Portland.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and Chair DeMay. The commission members have been doing some review of county mental health plans to see how Senate Bill 781 has been implemented, and we're frankly happy with what we've seen, because almost without exception, these plans at a minimum are acknowledging the distinct service needs that senior mental health patients require. And in fact, we have some counties who are actually offering a pretty wide range of service, from outreach to treatment for older Oregonians. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 781 had no money attached to it, and almost all counties are reporting that they're already having burdens to meet programs for families and children because of serious budget cuts that, you know, have taken place in the last couple of years. So making staff available to specifically serve seniors has been really difficult, if not impossible, in many cases. Part of the reason for this, we know, is because of a lack of specialized training for clinicians who treat older clients whose needs are very unique. Seniors are much more likely to experience depression and isolation, and as you're probably aware, suicide rates for this group are off the charts. They're for this age group, suicide rates are higher than for any other group. And we know that a lack of geropsychiatric training is one of the reasons that senior mental health issues are going unreported and untreated. So despite the best efforts of our community and mental health agencies, we're falling way short of meeting the need. And as you're also aware, we're aging. The number of people over 65 is going to double in Oregon in less than 20 years. And that means that the number of older adults needing mental health services is going to double in the next 20 years. And so, faced with that need to plan for that increase, we're already starting out in the hole. So the Governance Commission, as Chuck mentioned, is proposing one slight solution. It's certainly not a whole solution, but may get us based in the right direction. And we're supporting Senate Bill 847, which proposes a pilot project to train mental health professionals who serve the mental health needs of older Oregonians. That's certainly going to help us move in the right direction. It has a modest price tag, about $600,000, and we think that's the kind of wise investment that we ought to be able to afford and should be making today. And we look forward to our official public hearing on this bill in the next 2 weeks. Thanks again for listening to us this morning, and thanks for helping us prepare for this wave of boomers that's going to be on us, that is on us already. It's already here. And also, I'd just like to take a moment to express the Commission's thanks to our community mental health directors and their staffs, who do a pretty good job without a lot of resources. And we hope we can help them get the resources they need to do their job. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel?
Yes, Madam Cowan.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Speaker. Chair. Sorry. With apologies for my allergy outburst today, I'm getting through this as best I can. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate you folks bringing this particular subject to our attention and this piece of the overall mental health system. I personally cared for one of the members of my family through the end of her life, who went through significant geriatric psych problems and made her very challenging to get adequate care for. So I'm curious if the focus of your investigations and presentations are around the existing population of individuals who are coping with mental illness, who will then be moving into the upper age brackets in the course of the next few years, or more specifically to the onset of mental health problems at the geriatric level. I think there's kind of two different sorts of things we're needing to talk about, illnesses that are particular to aging individuals, and I was just curious if you had focused more on one end of that spectrum or the other.
Representative Cowan, I think we're looking at the issue in its kind of totality. I don't think that we're focusing on one aspect or the other, and our main concern is lack of services in all of those areas that you're talking about. There are unmet service needs in the mental health community in all ages. We're concerned, of course, about the very specific kinds of needs that seniors have and the very specific kind of training that's necessary to serve that group.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. I was pleased to see the information around the geriatric mental health specialist in the community services work group. That was educational for me. I guess my question would be, outside specific specialists at the community mental health partners, in our senior services in general, whether it's the AAAs or other programs, has there been an increased emphasis on providing some of the mental health, maybe in prevention issues, like Representative Cowan was talking about, that people who might not have had mental health issues in the past but now have them, they're being connected with senior services. Are there services in those agencies? Granted, maybe not full-blown mental health specialists, but did you look at that at all? I'm just curious.
Well, we were looking primarily at the community mental health system itself. I think that it's pretty common knowledge that all of our services for seniors are dreadfully underfunded, and so we think it's a widespread problem.
Any other discussion?
Thank you, panel.
Yes, oh, yes. I'm sorry, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much.
The $600,000 that you are recommending, is that part of the geriatric specialist package that is referenced in the community services work group report, or is this is the $600,000 separate request?
As I understand, these are separate requests, Senator Gourley. Maybe dealt with separately.
Any further questions?
Thank you. Unfortunately, we need to move on to the, I think, impact mental illness on community law enforcement. So Jim Davis and John, we're going to have to hold off to see if we have time to talk more on senior services at the end of this meeting. And I'd like to move on and bring up Ashley Brenton. And is Judge Sulander here? I know him as Bob. I went to a house dance with him in college. Start with you, Ashley.
Good morning. Are you ready for
yeah.
for me? My name is Ashley Brenton. I am a resident of Portland, Oregon, and a consumer of mental health. I
move it in front of you. Yeah.
I am a consumer of mental health. I have been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder following a broken neck that I had in 97. I had my first psychosis in June of 2000. And during that time, I was driving my car, and I was very psychotic, very paranoid, and just terrified, and had stopped several times at police stations to try to get help. I was finally, I stopped at a gas station to buy $10 of gas, and when the gas station attendant reached toward me for a payment, I thought he was trying to hurt me, and I sped off in my car, and his arm got stuck in the window of my car, and he later jumped off my car, and he got hurt. As a consequence of that, the police came up behind me, and I wouldn't stop for them because I thought they were bad men that had rented police cars. They finally pitted my car, and at gunpoint told me to get down on the ground, and I said, no, I'm not getting down on the ground. I know you're really not the police. I was charged with robbery and assault and attempting to elude police officers and was taken to jail, and I had not had a criminal history prior to this ever, and I was in jail for 3 months, and I was very uncooperative because I just wasn't in my right mind. I was finally taken to the Oregon State Hospital for evaluation and was stabilized on medication. And after about 3 months, I was released back into the community where I did quite well as long as I was on my medication. But the doctors took me off my medication because they thought my psychosis was due to a one-time use of ephedra, diet pills containing ephedra, and I relapsed, and not taking any alcohol or drugs or anything like that, I just relapsed having my psychosis again. And I was placed back at the Oregon State Hospital, and I remained there even though my doctor said I was able to leave after about 3 months. I remained at the hospital, at the Oregon State Hospital, for 2 years and 3 months. And that is an enormous amount of money for taxpayers to have to pay for people that are already stabilized on medication and cooperative and doing everything possible to be an asset to the community. I'm just, you know, outraged that people are warehoused at the hospital when they could be out in the community if there were more mental health resources available. We need more money. We're cutting programs. We're cutting art studios at the Cascadia. People need to be empowered by participating in meaningful activities. And we just need more money. We need more money for CIT trainings and
Well, thank you. That's mainly what I needed to say. Well, thank you, because it's your testimony that just drives home how we there's so much more work to be done, especially at the community level, and that's where the funding has to go so that you don't have to go through those experiences that you did. So thank you very much. Are there any questions for Ashley?
Yeah.
Ashley, so now you're getting treatment at Cascadia. I heard
well,
you
I am now. I am the program coordinator for NAMI, so I have Kaiser insurance, fortunately. But I was getting treatment from Cascadia for 7 years. I was under the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and I have been discharged from the Psychiatric Review Board. But for 7 years, I received care from Cascadia.
And are you still taking medications?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And will you be doing that the rest of your life?
Oh, yes.
Is that the assumption? Okay.
Yes. And my medication is so expensive. It's about it's over $400 a month. So it's a good thing that I have insurance to cover it. Otherwise, I, you know, may find myself in the same situation I did, you know, back when.
And your Kaiser insurance is covering your medication and your care.
Yes.
And will continue to do that.
Yes. Right. But I know of people that don't have insurance and can't get their medications, and I'm concerned about those people.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you.
Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, just to the committee, we had the budget for the Psychiatric Security Review Board in yesterday, and I'm glad the President is here to hear this. And in looking at their budget, it's costing us millions to be able to retain and to use your term to warehouse people when they should be able to go outside of this system. And the reason they can't go outside of the system, because we do not have, Mr. President, community housing, which is a very big shortage, and we don't have other community resources in place for people to leave. And so in the regular part of the hospital, it is cheaper to have people there than it is with the PSRB. And so we are spending a lot of money at the state system when we should be doing a much better job. I've heard Dr. Nichol tell us this over and over again. If we could find strong community resources available for people, we would not have to keep them at the hospital, and on top of that, in the PSRB unit.
Any other comments? Okay. Justine Lander. Thank you very much, Ashley.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson, Representative Tomei, members of the committee. I hesitate to use statistics because I'm remembered of the man who compared him to a bikini. What they reveal is suggestive. What they conceal is critical. But let me give you some statistics that I think are reliable.
That's a good one.
Roughly 16% of all people incarcerated in county jails have serious mental illnesses. And in my conversations with people from the Oregon State Penitentiary, I think that figure holds in the Oregon State Penitentiary. Serious mental illness is defined as major depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, panic disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and borderline disorder personality. We know it costs about a third more to incarcerate somebody with a mental illness than somebody without, so roughly $100 a day versus $76 a day because of the need for more jail staff, medication, and treatment. And we also know that people that have a mental illness are likely to spend substantially more time in a facility than people without a mental illness. In New York, the average stay of a person without a mental illness at their largest county jail was 42 days. It was in excess of 250 days for those people with mental illnesses. In an effort to improve public safety and to more effectively handle our limited resources in the criminal justice system, Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and Mental Health Department, Clackamas County Community Corrections, and the Circuit Court began a collaborative effort, and we began Oregon's first mental health court. We did it on this premise, that there are people who are committing crimes because of their mental illness. That's a difficult phrase for a judge to use, because we have defenses for people with mental illness. I'm not talking about people with defenses. I'm talking about people that are suffering from a mental illness that would not win in a jury trial or would not be found guilty but insane. Say it another way. We were hopeful that we could significantly reduce criminal activity in some individuals simply by treating their mental illness. A mental health court is a treatment court. We require participants to engage in counseling or therapy, to take all the medications they're prescribed, to attend all counseling and court sessions, and not to commit any crimes. And because we recognize that about 75% of people suffering from mental illness in the criminal justice system also have a co-occurring disorder of drug abuse or alcohol abuse, we require alcohol and drug counseling. These are our statistics. In 2003, the people we had in mental health court averaged 1.38 bookings in the Clackamas County Jail the year before mental health court. During mental health court, it dropped to 0.37 bookings per year. What is amazing is that not one of our graduates has ever been booked into the Clackamas County Jail since. Now, difficulty with the statistic is of the people we've graduated, four of them have died violent deaths. Two of them have been killed as a result of police action. Others have killed themselves. The only thing that is prohibiting us from expanding our program is money, and it's money for treatment and case managers and medication and housing, and she said it better than I can. The mental health insurance parity program passed by the legislature last session is a huge step forward. Senator Courtney, I respect your efforts on building mental health facilities at the state level. But we need local facilities, we need community programs, and we need help for people that have no insurance. And most of the people coming through the criminal justice system have no insurance, and so there's no parity to help them. Now, I'm sure that I'm naive about both legislative and administrative processes, but it appears to me that historically it's easier to bury the expense by not treating the problem. And so we continue by ignoring, by not arresting, by arresting and releasing, by holding and not treating, but the mental health crisis is not going to go away. Far too many tragedies are occurring on the front page of the Oregonian, and far too many people with mental illnesses are overburdening the criminal justice system unnecessarily. We know that mental health court works. We know they're less expensive, and they're more effective than the normal criminal justice process. I want to be careful about what I'm saying, because mental health court is not the best alternative in the criminal justice system. We should have a diversion program before people get into the criminal justice system. We can't put it together in Clackamas County because we don't have the resources to do it. But in places where it's been done, it keeps people out of the system before they get in. And I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I was trying to limit my
time. Thank you. Thank you very much, Judge. Are there any questions for, yes?
Judge C. Lender, maybe you told us this, but how many people have graduated from the mental health court?
I think about 70 now.
70, okay.
At the highest, we had 60 people in the program. That's about what we're trying to do.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does mental health court differ in any significant way from a drug court? Because it sounds to me like it's similar protocols. And does it differ significantly in cost of administering?
Senator, I think the answer is no to both your questions.
Okay.
I also do Clackamas County Adult Drug Court.
Okay.
And we looked at doing one court that handled both. The people in our mental health court are fragile. The people in my drug court are not necessarily fragile. And they are the type of people that would take or may take advantage of fragile people. And so we tried to separate out people so they were not taken advantage of. We do have people going back and forth between mental health court and drug court. Sometimes very difficult to know if the initial problem was a mental health problem or a drug problem or both. But that's why we have two courts. The 10 key components of drug courts that are recognized nationally we use in mental health court.
Interesting. Any other questions? Thank you. And if you need to leave, you can. Go ahead. And for the record, introduce yourself.
My name is Greg Borders, and I'm the clinical director for crisis services at Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare, Oregon's largest community-based provider of mental health and addictions treatment. In my professional role, I oversee several crisis programs, including Cascadia's mobile outreach crisis team. Our teams are a resource for law enforcement and the hospitals, including the emergency departments and the community at large. Last year, we received over 900 calls from the police to assist officers who were called onto a scene and identified the individual as needing mental health treatment. We received over 550 calls from hospital emergency departments in an effort for us to come in and divert the hospitalization if possible and set up a longer-term plan for that individual. And we received over 4,000 calls from the community at large, including landlords, families, schools, etc. Our work plays an important role in reducing the impact of a mental health crisis on our hospitals and police departments. Both the ERs and the police benefit from our assistance because we are often able to divert hospitalizations and arrests. Our goal is to assist individuals to remain in the community whenever possible. The work that we do has a powerful and important impact, not only on the people living with mental illness, but also on the taxpayers, since we divert away from the most costly systems of care. But without the needed state investment in local, community-based systems of mental health care, our effectiveness is limited when responding to a person in crisis. This is because when we encounter an individual in crisis, our task is to address the presenting crisis and to stabilize the situation by referring to other health care, housing, and drug and alcohol treatment programs. Filling the gaps in these services is what's needed to protect the investment made in the crisis response. Without that, my crisis teams seem to be called back on another day to visit a similar situation from that individual. An effective mental health system includes crisis teams to assist individuals in immediate need, but it must also include the necessary other services for long-term stability, including mental and physical health care, housing, and drug and alcohol and addiction services. That's where we have a gap, and that's where we need attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any? This was the panel that addressed the impact of mental illness on the community law enforcement and the judicial system. So, is there any other questions for this panel before we move on? Yes, Representative Pickett.
Thank you, Chair. I'm looking at the community services work group report. Thank you for being here on the crisis services section. How I'm familiar with Cascadia. So, do most places have some level of mobile crisis services, or some have none at all? I'm just trying to get a sense of the range statewide of where we are on this type of service.
I think it's unusual. I don't know how many counties may have this. I know that Clackamas County doesn't and is interested in pursuing it. And 2 years ago, we started up a similar program in Washington County, and those are the only two that I'm aware of.
Follow-up? Was that the type of diversion you were referring to?
That's part of the diversion I'm referring to.
Do you want to elaborate on the diversion
sure,
just quickly?
Every Clackamas County deputy, as soon as the Multnomah County, is going to go through the crisis intervention training to learn, among other things, how to recognize mental illness. Every corrections officer in the Clackamas County Jail is going to go through that training to recognize mental illness. And we have a mental illness treatment provider at the county jail. If we can recognize early that somebody is suffering from a mental illness, and we can do two things. We can give a medication that's necessary, and for a long enough time that they stay on it. Right now, as soon as they're out of jail, they're off their medication. Goes to somebody else's budget. And so if we could recognize they have a mental illness, give them the medication, and then give them someplace to go, someplace like Cascadia, that is going to keep track of them, hold their hand, and walk them through the system. Then we never have to file criminal charges. We never have to have a mental health court. And if that doesn't work, and if they continue to get into problems, then we can bring them into something like mental health court and still keep them out of the traditional system. But that's why it's part of the solution. It's not the total solution on diversion.
Thank you.
Can I follow up?
Follow up. Thank you. That's helpful. And this is, you prompted another question in my mind. Could you speak to the problems we're having with reduction in the Oregon Health Plan standard population in terms of access to mental health treatment and how that's affected the court systems or Cascadia?
Well, he can answer the Cascadia. My problem with Cascadia is we have trouble getting people in because they're overburdened, so I don't know what his response is going to be. Most people we have no insurance, none whatsoever. If they don't have Oregon health insurance money, then we have to try and find some place where they can get medication, where they can get on the scholarship for medication, or where somebody's going to treat them for free. That's very difficult to do. Those places simply aren't available. So the lower we go on the Oregon health plan, the more people that I'm seeing are going to be left without. And if we don't have services, then we're going to put them through the traditional system because we have nothing else to do with them. And we're going to pay for them another way, and we're going to pay for them more expensively another way.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, just to comment. We have seen a tremendous problem within the mental health system since the reductions in the Oregon Health Plan. In Multnomah County, we have Verity Plus, which can basically give mental health insurance to people that are absolutely at the most in need. However, we're seeing a lot of people that fall through the gaps. They don't quite meet Verity Plus eligibility. And as a result of that, we're seeing a tremendous amount of homelessness in Portland. And I think, you know, drug and alcohol use, crimes, things like that have risen as well due to that.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony. When Ashley was speaking, it triggered for me a hearing that we're having tomorrow night in Corvallis about a bill that seeks to address the issues of the interaction between law enforcement and people with mental illness. And I'm with this bill, I struggle a little bit between the balance between privacy and safety of the individual and officers. What this bill would do would be to allow individuals with significant mental illness who have frequent encounters with law enforcement to voluntarily have information put into the law enforcement data system so that when they encounter someone, they know who that person is, they're able to connect them up to a support person and understand what the safety flags are. For example, telling someone to get down on the ground at gunpoint might escalate a situation and really not be helpful. Do you think that type of a solution is the right way to go in terms of improving those interactions, or do you have other recommendations for how, before individuals are ending up in jails or in prisons, how to keep them from getting there in the first place and to keep them safe when they're encountering law enforcement?
Well, I would support that bill just because I as long as the officers have been trained appropriately with the CIT trainings, I think more emphasis should be on the CIT trainings. I think the EMTs with the fire department, I think they need to be trained as well. But I'm all for that. I would voluntarily give my information to the police department if I felt comfortable that they had been trained to recognize mental illness.
Interesting.
Thank you. I just want to actually, the hearing tomorrow is in Albany, not Corvallis.
Oh, sorry, that was very Corvallis centric of me. It's in Albany.
And please, we'd love to have all of you here who are interested in this issue. And I noticed that you read from material. If you could give that to our staff over here, then it can be reprinted for the rest of us. And I'd like to invite anyone who has written material, whether or not you have time to read it today, if you have it, if you could give it to staff, and then we would put it in our files, and that would be very helpful.
Any other questions? Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Great for you. Didn't get to listen to all your testimony, but you intrigued me with some of the comments that you had initially. In your response to assist law enforcement at scenes with mental ill people, what have you ever kind of determined how much time that has saved the police once you've arrived and kind of taken over? You know, for them to return back to duties.
Sure. Well, just to start, I would say about 40% of our calls originate from the police, so we're very involved with the police and have a wonderful relationship with them. I don't know, you know, over a pattern how much time we're saving, but it could be considerably 3 or 4 hours, because it takes a long time for the police to... If the police decide we don't know what to do, we're going to take this person to the hospital, they could be waiting in the waiting room for 3 or 4 hours.
Right.
Versus when our team comes out, we may determine that there's a better plan. And often we say to the police, thank you for being here, you've been great, and we'll finish it up here, and we'll continue to work with the individual. And particularly with children and families, those calls can last 6 to 7 hours, which would not be a good resource for the police.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, all three of you, for being here.
I'd like to move on now to Oregon's inpatient psychiatric system, and we have Robin Henderson from St. Charles Medical Center and Mike May from Samaritan Health Centers, if you would come up. And I know we're falling. This is so interesting. I know we're falling behind on time, but again, 2 minutes, but it doesn't work out that way.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, and Representative Tomei, and the rest of the distinguished panel, who I feel like I'm getting to know quite well. I get to go home today, so this is a good thing for me. Dr. May and I are here on behalf of the Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Committee, which is part of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And we kind of have these sandwiches.
And for the record, you are?
Oh, I'm so sorry. For the record, I'm Dr. Robin Henderson, Director of Behavioral Health Services at St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, Oregon. We have a sandwich testimony for you today, so I'm going to kick off. Dr. May has some meat in that, and then I have the other slice of bread on the other side. So the Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Committee is comprised of representatives from all of the 16 acute care units across the state. We are each part of larger not-for-profit hospital systems and health care systems in many of your communities. We're a volunteer committee. We've been together. We're potential competitors. And yet 6 years ago, we came together because we knew we had to deal with the acute care system, and we could only do it by sharing our serious mutual concerns with each other and working together. Even though our primary focus is on acute care inpatient issues, our role in the system of care requires that we interface with other hospitals, the Addictions and Mental Health Division, county mental health programs, law enforcement, and the county judicial processes. As such, we're integrally invested in every aspect of the primary components of the mental health system of care in Oregon. Changes to any of these components can have a significant impact on our ability to provide quality and effective care. There are 278 acute care beds in Oregon. 278. We provide services to all age groups, both public and private, voluntary and involuntary. We represent the first line of inpatient treatment, and we're the gatekeepers for the civil commitment system. Most of the folks who are transferred to the Oregon State Hospital pass through our doors at one time or another, and when folks are on a commitment in the community and they have difficulties, they often will pass back through us on their way through. Many of the folks we serve will never see the inside of the Oregon State Hospital, and we're very glad that we're able to provide the level of quality to help folks work through their issues quickly and get out of the system. We agree with the need for a new Oregon State Hospital facility. We absolutely do want to simultaneously address the system of care infrastructure that will make the new state hospitals function as designed. To that end, we have vociferously participated in the Oregon Community Mental Health Coalition to outline the first steps in making progress toward a healthy and sane mental health system. There will be more information about this work group in other testimony that you've heard today and that you'll continue to hear, but suffice it to say, we are outraged at the lack of response to the call for services.
Good morning, Chair Mons Anderson Tomei. I'm Dr. Michael May, Vice President and Medical Director for Samaritan Mental Health, Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis. I want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about the master plan and some of the issues that we believe are important to draw further attention to. The current master plan design appears to make assumptions about the entire acute care system, including the inpatient units. With respect to the acute care inpatient units, the assumptions are not entirely clear. Appendix F of the master plan, titled Project Assumptions, makes absolutely no reference to the acute care units. The default assumption and presumed expectation must be that the not-for-profit hospitals will continue to provide whatever acute care services are necessary, including providing care to patients who are admitted involuntarily and those who are civilly committed to the care and custody of the state mental health division. Given the current condition of the acute care system, this is an ill-founded assumption. The references that are made about the acute care inpatient units in the master plan document are few. Page 2 of the executive summary identifies the need to, quote, improve the movement of persons through the system by adequate state funding of enhancements to acute care and community-based programs, unquote. On page 10 of the report, it states, without the enhanced community programming, demand for OSH beds will substantially exceed projections in size and cost. There are two components of the community-based programs that will affect OSH utilization: community-based residential programs and critical front-end services, end quote. That is to say, the front door, which are the community mental health programs in the acute care system, acute care inpatient units, and the back door, the residential care, which are primarily operated by county mental health programs. In a section titled Continuum of Care, acute care hospitals are referenced as providing, quote, a critical function in the continuum, end quote. And on page 21, the report states, hospitals are experiencing increased financial struggles, and psychiatric units in particular are under greater scrutiny as hospitals are faced with difficult decisions regarding which services to keep and which to exit. The difficult financial situation for hospital psychiatric units has resulted in reductions in beds, and some of those units and closure of one psychiatric hospital. Acute care capacity in Oregon has been further reduced with closures of two other hospitals related to poor clinical performance and overall hospital financial issues. This trend threatens a critical safety net and program setting for those with mental illness, end quote. We believe that this identifies but significantly understates the problem. There have, in fact, been 8 unit closures and bed reductions at 6 of the currently operating facilities. Acute care bed closures are primarily related to funding. Acute care psychiatric beds are a drain on the hospital resources because they consistently lose money. Even though mission-driven, many not-for-profit hospitals are not going to be able to continue or willing to continue to cover these costs with revenue-producing services. At this time, Mercy Medical Center is scheduled to close their 29 acute care beds by the middle of this year if there is no solution found to their annual losses on psychiatric inpatient services, which in 2006 amounted to $1.9 million. On page 3 of the master plan introduction, it states the consultant team's objective was to, quote, review and evaluate inpatient and outpatient services throughout the state of Oregon and recommend appropriate changes and enhancements to the system. In 2005, there were over 6,000 admissions to the acute care psychiatric units, compared with less than 1,000 admissions to Oregon State Hospital. It is apparent that in addition to hospital beds in the state hospital system, many patients are served in acute care hospital beds. The adequacy, location, and viability of these beds were not attended to in the Phase 2 report and so fall short of the stated objective. The census projections out to 2030 do not include data on acute care inpatient needs. And so it follows that in the operating and developmental cost section of the report on page 13, there is no mention of the potential costs associated with acute care units. There currently are and will continue to be significant costs associated with provision of acute inpatient service. Oregon Psychiatric Inpatient Committee is concerned that the report does not address these costs, and that this committee and others will be broadsided in the future when these costs become apparent or when the acute care infrastructure deteriorates to such a point that the proposed plan is inadequate to meet the need. It is imperative that the adoption of the master plan factor in and justify all the costs to the proposed new system of care. Components of the system that will make this work, this plan work, include all the front-end and back-end services, including in the acute care inpatient units. Thank you.
I have
a real concern. If I had a magic wand and could design a mental health system, I would have a mental health system that would have a crisis management team in every community. I don't know if we will get there. I don't even know if that will be part of the direction that the state will take. But right now, it looks like we need the acute care beds in the local hospitals at this point in time. But with the idea that in the future, hopefully, we will have community mental health residential treatment centers that could care for this. I don't know what the cost is. I haven't even talked with anyone else regarding this concept. But how would the hospitals, if we have to take care of it today, how many in the Samaritan system beds would you need more than what is now? Or is it the funding, or how much is it? How much do you get for each acute care bed? Let's put it that way. And then how many beds would you need? And then the same for St. Charles.
Madam Chair, to answer your question, I think that the acute care hospital system has an adequate number of beds overall right now. If we didn't have waitlisted folks to the state hospital, and if there were improved services prior to coming into the hospital. It's hard for me to answer your question about how many more beds we need in the acute care system in Corvallis. In the written data that we've given you, it points out that 40% of the patients that were on the unit that I run down in Corvallis on Tuesday of this week, 40% of them were from out of our area. We have patients from Multnomah County, Clackamas County, Lane County, Douglas County. So these patients are coming into us from all over the state. I don't need any more beds in our acute care hospital to serve the needs of the people in our primary service area, which is Linn County, Benton County, and Lincoln County. The problem for us is that we are required to take patients from anywhere that there's a need if we have a bed. And we don't have relationships with all the counties in the state. We're working on that, but we don't. So our losses are primarily related to out-of-area folks that come into our hospital. So if you're asking me, could I open more beds? Yes, I could open more beds.
But that's not the...
But it would just mean a greater loss for me because I'd be opening beds for other parts of the state. I also think the acute care system can be part of the solution with respect to residential beds, step-down services, and other services. But our hospitals are skittish at this point about entering into any more agreements with the state to provide additional services, given the fact that the services we're providing are so poorly funded and are so at risk to get further cuts. So I think we can provide some of the solutions in addition to what we're already doing. But I think we have to see this other part shored up first before we're going to be interested in talking about those things.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I can give you a couple very clear examples. For instance, in our community in Central Oregon, we were one of the last communities to get Service Element $24, which paid for the provision of indigent care. And right now, currently, because we have so few dollars in that line item, we made an agreement with our region to go at risk for that as a hospital. And they give us a large portion of those dollars, and we cover all of the voluntary and involuntary patients on the two units that we have. And that's the agreement that we made. Last year when we did our accounting, I was reimbursed less than $500 per day. Less than $500 per day. Not only does that not cover my cost of care, that doesn't cover the cost of the physicians that I have to pay for to care for these patients. I attempted to open my 15-bed unit as a residential unit, believing that I could lower my costs and take advantage of some of the state's regulations to fill the acute care need and staff it as an acute care unit. And while in part that worked, it has some difficulties in terms of our Medicare regulations because Medicare does not reimburse at a residential lower level of care. So I'm in the process of changing to I-2 occupancy. I won't change the population I take. I take Medicare right now. I get nothing, zero, because we have a commitment to serve everyone in our community. 95% of the people we see come from Central and Eastern Oregon. But recently I took a few patients from Washington County because we needed to. We have no contract with them. We were mandated to take them because we were the last empty bed in the state. And they decided that they would reimburse us at $500 per day for that privilege and charge us for the bus ticket back. Thank you very much. It's difficult. It's very difficult. I'm willing to take those hits for my own community because that's what we do. We're the largest inpatient provider east of the Cascades. And when you have the opportunity to come to Bend, please call me and come see. But it's very hard to stomach when it's outside the region and outside my mission.
Just to follow up on the funding piece, I mean, there are, and I don't know which hospitals are better off than others, but some of the statements that I hear from constituents, hospitals make so much money. And some hospitals have great profit margins. Why can't they just cost shift? And so could you respond to that?
You know, St. Charles had a margin last year somewhere between 3 and 5%. And out of that margin, we have to pay for construction, new equipment, everything else. Our capital budgets get cut and cut and cut. The margin is extraordinarily slim. Senator Cruz asked me a question about how much did behavioral health lose. And on this document, you'll see that one of my two units lost $600,000 last year. But I was responding to the question of total behavioral health losses because I have six departments. I'm responsible for outpatient care, for children's sexual abuse evaluations, forensic evaluations in our community, which are a totally unreimbursed service. All of those other types of things we do to take care of our community add up so that we can reduce our losses. There's not a lot of margin there, at least at St. Charles. I can't speak to other hospitals, but I would encourage you to look at some of the transparency website issues that have come up on the Hospital Association's website that show you about the charges and the cost of care and how much we do fund these things.
Okay, Senator Gorman.
Thank you very much. I'm looking at the document that we have from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and the statement that it would take an additional $8.7 million in the next biennium to fund acute psychiatric services at an adequate level. I'm looking for the alignment in between the statement that's here and the Community Services Work Group report, where on page 13 of that report there are recommendations for funding to acute care regions. And the cost amount listed in this document is $8.37 million. Are we talking about the same thing?
Yes. Senator Gordley, I think some of the discrepancy between these numbers is a result of how we got to these numbers. The numbers that you're looking at as the grid of the seven hospitals, those numbers are a combination of indigent care, Oregon Health Plan, and some Medicare, Medicaid patients. So it's limited to primarily the patients that are somehow associated with some kind of state funding or federal funding. And I don't think any of our units are expecting to make a windfall on these patients. We would like very much to get the cost of care that we incur via our Medicare cost reports. So when we're asking for a certain amount of money, we're not asking for a windfall. We're asking to try to get closer to breaking even. I think we recognize the point of view that the hospitals, many hospitals, do very well financially. When our group first started to get together, it was during the economic downturn years back when funding got cut. And when the state hospital or the state mental health division decided to cut payment for waitlisted folks that we were seeing, a category of waitlisted folks, we've gotten into better times. The hospitals, I think, overall are doing better. From my point of view, speaking personally, I would like to see mental health care pay for itself. I don't think people should make money off of it. I don't think hospitals should make money off of it. But every time there's a downturn in the economy, or a hospital gets into tough times, they're going to start looking to cut.
Mm-hmm.
And mental health is one of the first things that gets cut. It's one of the first things to get cut by society, and it's one of the first things to get cut by hospitals. And the only way we're going to be able to maintain quality care, hire quality people to take care of folks, which I believe will actually an overall reduce cost because you don't have people coming and going and you've got a stable, steady group that you're working with to take care of patients. I think we need to get to a point where we recognize that the upfront costs that go into this are going to pay off in the long run. I believe that's true.
Just to follow up, I would just point out that, appreciating what you said, that in the Community Services Work Group report and the recommendation that I've referred to, if the legislature were to fund at $8.37 million, we're still saying that that would only meet 75% mm-hmm. of the unmet need. That's the point in this other document. Mm-hmm. So I just want to put that out there and be clear about what it is you're recommending and where the alignment is.
Well, I think part of the alignment from our perspective is that we recognize that this is an entire system of care. We are only one player yes. in that system of care. Yes. But we're to the point now where we cannot lose more units. We cannot lose more beds in this state. And if Mercy loses their 29 beds, we are going to have a huge problem, more than we have right now. We have people in emergency rooms all the time. There's hardly a week goes by I don't get called from one of my emergency room docs in one of my five hospitals because they've had to hold on to somebody for 12 hours and couldn't find a place for them to go. And I point out to them that is nothing compared to what's happening in Multnomah County and the Portland hospitals where they've actually had to go on divert because they had too many mental health patients mm-hmm. in their unit. Mm-hmm. And when you've got one of your two level three trauma centers on divert because of patients in the emergency room that can't be placed psychiatrically, that's a big problem.
Okay. Yes, Senator Carter.
So, Doctor, do you see where one day, since we've tried to unify the system in terms of physical and behavioral health, that when a person enter a hospital, they come in as a patient, not a patient who is mentally ill or a patient who is physically ill. The economics of this needs to take place at some point. Mm-hmm. How do we unify that?
Senator Carter, I don't have magic wand for those things like anybody else, but I guess in my mind, as I mentioned, I think mental health funding should be on par with medical care funding.
And I agree.
And I think that when it comes to funding for patients on units like ours, there needs to be at least something close to cost of care so that we can maintain quality. I think that there is a huge gap between the physical medical side and the mental health side.
Yes.
Part of that's created by the fact that, you know, we have community mental health programs that take care of a large population of people, but we don't have community health programs other than the ones that are mandated. It's a split system. You know, we're split between physical health and mental health, and then mental health is split between addiction medicine and mental health medicine and disability services. Funding streams go down these different tracks that have to be spent on certain items for certain things. Blending funds is extremely difficult for organizations to do. We've tried it numerous times in Corvallis to get people to blend funds for child services. I think we have a significantly broken system, and I think there has to be really substantive change. I also think that we have probably got the best opportunity now that I'm aware of in Oregon. I've only been here since 91. This is the first time that I remember that a group of quality mental health people from around the state, the counties, the MHOs, the hospitals, and many others have come together as a coalition to say, you know, we're arm in arm with this. We need help. And we see with the writing on the wall, things are not going to go well if we don't start funding some of this in a better way.
Madam Chair, the reason yes. I asked that question yes. is because I think the legislature does have a role to play in what is going on, and a big part of this is looking at the culture of healthcare in our country and certainly in our state. And as long as we have the imaginary line between physical and behavioral health, we're going to be constantly dealing with this issue. Because if you look at the Portland area alone, as per this Oregon Association of Hospitals, we're talking about a $7.1 million deficit for hospitals. This does not even include the community portion of what is going on. So we're talking about an infusion of about $2 billion in this state to handle just mental health issues alone. You and I both know that unless new monies, new revenue is put into the system, that's going to be an almost impossible task to have happen. So what does the legislature do in the meantime becomes an issue for all of us to try to address as it relates to this particular issue. Now, there is no way this legislature
legislature, with the kind of resources that we are lacking at this particular moment, can come to any kind of agreement toward $116 million that is needed to infuse community mental health services across this state today. But I think it is very important for us as legislators to realize that this is a system that is not only broke, but if every community decides that they want to give us back the problem of mental health in this state, then you're going to see us scrambling in a way that we've never scrambled before, because then the federal government is going to come in, as it has done in the past, and say, Oregon, you clean up your backyard. And then we're going to be faced with all kind of lawsuits. So I'm hoping that we're taking in consideration the testimony that is being given here today, and that we look at it more seriously in terms of what we do. But all of you out there need to also look that there needs to be an infusion of new dollars, and you can't get around paying some taxes to have it done.
Thank you, Senator Carter. There's more to the problem than just adding more money, and I think the hospitals, which may fight this, we're looking at it in the healthcare reform committee, as well as we're going to be hearing a bill on certificate of need regarding how many MR machines do we really need, how many ASCs do we really need. I mean, there's a whole lot of maybe accountability that we need to have in Oregon regarding healthcare facilities. Whether this will save money for the system or not, that's yet to be debated. But I'm putting you on notice that there will be a discussion on certificate of need, trying to contain costs. We want the system to cost less than it is now, and it's an uphill battle. Okay. Any other questions for this group?
Yes, Dr. May, you read from some materials, and I could not find it in my pile of things. If you could give your written materials, I can't remember if you've written that.
We're sharing the same testimony.
Okay, if you could give that would be great, because my notes could not keep up with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just really briefly. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably to both of you, because you were involved, I think, with the Community Services Work Group. Page 13, near the top, it says, AMH will soon announce a planning process to assess statewide need for both acute care hospital and non-hospital alternatives. Is that happening? Is that this? Is it something else? I'm just trying to get a handle, and maybe that's a Dr. Nickel question. But since you're on the group, I didn't know if there's more work to do on the acute care and that it's coming. Or
there definitely is an assessment, Representative Kotek. There's definitely an assessment that needs to be done. And I know we're working with AMH around some primary issues and cost of care and things like that, but I don't think we've jumped into the assessment as of yet.
Okay.
Dr. Mady, you?
Yeah. Especially with that, you're going from moving people around the state issue.
Okay. It's very, very frequent. We look at this much as like two people jumping out of an airplane, and there's only one parachute. And right now, the state hospital has the parachute. And if we don't join hands and go together, we're both going to hit the ground, but one of us won't survive.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. So that takes care of what we want to have said at this point in time on Oregon's inpatient psychiatric system. Now we're going to go to the nonprofit community mental health providers. Leslie Ford, from a CEO from Cascadia, Susan Bann, Shelter Care, and Tracy Dumach is a consumer. Come on. Please try to limit your testimony, because we have three more after you.
Chair Tomei, Chair Mona Sanderson, and committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Oh, and Judy McCartney was supposed to be a part of this.
Okay,
she's there. All right.
My name's Leslie Ford, and I have the privilege and the challenge of being the CEO of Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. We provided mental health and addiction services and housing services to over 20,000 Oregonians this last year. And I'm here to speak to you about the community system of care. The success of the state hospital plan is predicated on making significant new investments in Oregon's community system of community-based services. Without that, the state hospital will be playing the wrong role in the system and will once again become overwhelmed, as will local hospitals and our jail and criminal justice systems. A better way to serve Oregonians is a system that minimizes reliance on the most costly and often least appropriate end of the service spectrum. It's a system that embraces the reality of dual diagnosis and the need to invest in treating both illnesses and addictions, but most importantly, it's a system of care. A system of community care needs to support the recovery of individuals suffering from mental health, mental illness, and addictions. It needs to have a crisis system coupled with jail diversion programs aimed at keeping people in crisis out of jail and out of the hospital. It needs to maximize access to care so that people don't have to wait for a crisis to receive services and support, but can instead be consistently supported as they recover. It needs to provide supportive housing because everything we do is less effective when someone doesn't have a home. It needs to provide intensive service options, including assertive community treatment acts and crisis respite, so that people struggling with severe mental illness can continue to live successfully in the community. It needs to provide supported employment and education opportunities so that people in recovery can lead the fullest, richest lives possible. All of this, coupled with an array of acute care services and early intervention and prevention services, make up a system. I'm here to encourage you to invest in building a system of community care for Oregonians suffering from mental illness and addictions, and to draw your attention to some of the data from other states to illustrate the powerful impact of such a system. We would have more local Oregon outcome data, but in the last 4 years, we haven't been able to afford to do much outcome research. In New York State, where they've widely embraced the model of intensive case management, known as ACT, clients have experienced a 42% reduction in ER visits, a 40% reduction in homelessness, and a 48% reduction in psychiatric hospitalizations. In San Francisco, the commitment to supportive housing has resulted in a 56% drop in emergency room visits, a 37% drop in medical or psychiatric inpatient stays, a 44% reduction in inpatient days, and a 44% reduction in days sentenced in incarceration. In Oregon, addictions treatment services for women who've lost their children to foster care results in a 50% increase in of folks regaining child custody, and 42% who are employed at point of discharge. These statistics serve to illustrate what a robust community mental health and addiction system can accomplish for affected individuals and for taxpayers. And as you know, we've had a 40% reduction in rates paid to community service providers in the last 4 years, in addition to the elimination of OHP standard, which has had a substantial effect on our ability to maintain people at a lower level of care. I encourage you all to support the investment in community-based mental health, as recommended by the Oregon Community Mental Health Coalition, to make the investment in addiction treatment services, and to increase the number of Oregonians covered by the Oregon Health Plan. I think these investments will play a big return for our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairs. Excuse me. I have to get my voice back. And members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. I'm Susan Bann. I'm the executive director of Shelter Care, which is a private nonprofit in Lane County. We opened in 1970 with a homeless shelter for homeless families, an emergency shelter. And in the 1970s, as the institutionalization began to happen, we began to see more and more people with severe persistent mental illness moving through our shelter. At that point, we expanded. Today, we operate 11 different programs for continuing to serve families who are homeless. We also serve adults with acquired or traumatic brain injury, and we have a number of programs for adults who have psychiatric disabilities, everything from supported housing, supported employment, supported education, crisis respite, subacute care in the community. So we, as an agency, believe that recovery is possible for people with psychiatric disability, and we see that every day. We know that when provided housing and provided supports, people can move into meaningful, productive, engaged lives. And that's our mission, and that's what we do. We have 150 individuals in supported housing on any given day, and our waiting list for those units is three times that number. Where Tracy lives, in the Hawthorne Apartments, the wait can be 2 years before people get into one of those units. We could fill several Hawthorne Apartments in a flash.
Let me describe Hawthorne briefly and a couple of other programs briefly, and then I'm going to pass it on to the consumers who come with me. Hawthorne, we opened in 1982. It was a model, a statewide model, a national model of supported community living for adults with psychiatric disabilities. 35 units that are set up in a way that encourages community, so apartments open into a common area where people are encouraged to engage socially and have services on site in a clustered setting. We now have 150 units in the community, so we've grown from that initial model. We also opened last year a housing first model that uses assertive community treatment. It's Assertive Community Treatment Act Lite, because it's not we don't have the resources to do it fully. We have 8 units in the community. And this is for people who are moving out of the psychiatric unit at our local hospital who would otherwise be indigent or homeless. None of them have service medical coverage attached to them. They are all indigent. None of them yet qualify for Oregon Health Plan. So this is community funded, not necessarily mental health funded. These people move into housing, and just an illustration of what housing first and intensive supports can do. One of the residents had 37 hospitalizations in the 2 years prior to entering this Housing First program, has been in the program 7 months and has had literally one hospitalization, and it was for a medical condition, not a behavioral health condition. Another individual in the year prior had 11 hospitalizations, again, both for medical and mental health issues, and has had none since entering into housing. So there is clearly a connection between providing housing and elimination of demand on higher cost care. So I am here today to emphasize the importance of state funding for community programs. I was privileged to serve on the Oregon State Hospital Community Work Group. I truly believe that if we put community services in place at the local level, that we will see a parallel drop at the state level. And so I ask you to increase funding for community-based services. And then I want to thank the 3 consumers who came with me. Debbie O'Quinn from Hawthorne will not be speaking. Tracy Dumas from Hawthorne will. And then Judy McCartney is in our Royal Avenue program.
Thank you.
Hi, chairs.
And bring the microphone to you.
Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Tracy Dumas, and as Susan said, I live in supported housing at the Hawthorne Shelter Cares Hawthorne program in Eugene, Oregon. And I'm here today to tell you what a difference that supportive housing and community-based mental health services have made for me. Until recently, I was in and out of crisis, mostly in crisis. I used a lot of crisis services, crisis lines, ambulances, police, detox, psychiatric hospitals at least 60 times, emergency shelters, emergency rooms, intensive care, and et cetera. In between crises, I would use county mental health services and lots of medications to try to stay out of crisis and not be a danger to myself. I think the only reason that I'm alive today is because I moved into supported housing at Hawthorne. No, there was no immediate miraculous change. It was slow changes for me, but there were important changes through the years. For one thing, I had stable, affordable, and safe housing and felt safer than ever before in my life. Another change was that I had Hawthorne staff to help arrange and coordinate services that I needed from other sources in the community. I began to have longer periods between crises and shorter hospital stays. It was easier to work on ways to deal with past trauma and develop skills to stay mentally healthy. I was able to complete a PhD program with much encouragement and support from the staff where I lived. My greatest changes have come in the past year or so. I have not been in the psych hospital for over a year, which is a miracle, and I have been able to successfully be off psychiatric medications for about 9 months. My psychiatrist and my counselor and I think that I'm doing well, and I think I'm doing better than I've ever done in my whole life. I feel better, and I'm involved in a number of community organizations
that have to do with domestic violence, trauma, mental health, and disability issues among committees, boards, and councils at the state level and the local level. I'm not entirely sure what happened in my case to stop this cycle of needing so many crisis services, but I think that probably a lot of it was due to the increase in individualized strength-based community consumer-driven emphasis of services at the housing program, at Shelter Care's housing program, and also receiving peer-delivered services from other communities in the Eugene area. And I guess that I want to say that a lot of money has been spent on me, and I've always felt like I was a drain to the system, and a lot of money was spent because I was in the hospitals and all that, and I know this, and there's a lot of other consumers that are like me, and I think that the hope for us lies in, you know, having programs such as the one at Shelter Care, where they do treat you as an individual, and where they do listen to you, and where they put you in control of what is happening to you. And that's, I think it's one of the unique, a very unique program talking to other consumers around the state. I really believe Shelter Care's program is one of the best, and that it can really help people and also prevent us from having to use so many crisis services and being a drain on the mental health funding. And also the peer delivered services, I think, are really important. And also maybe if we could put some money into having like houses or apartments that are just set up to help people who are to keep them out of the hospital, because I think sometimes that's, you know, a lot of people that I know that I've met in the hospitals, then it would be helpful to them to have a place where they could go instead of the hospital, because the hospital is not, you know, the answer. It's not as good that we have them and everything, but, you know, I don't think it's helpful, and it really makes people dependent, and it just can create a cycle, a bigger cycle. And so I think that's what I think.
Thank you very, very much for coming.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
You have completed your PhD in
yes.
what area?
Sociology.
And you are now Dr. Dumas?
I guess.
Dr. Dumas. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Chairs Moniz Anderson and Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Judy McCartney. I'm one of the not geriatric generation. One of you who, through a traumatic event of losing my husband, lost everything. I didn't fit. There was no place to go. I fell apart. If it weren't for the crisis services that are provided or Shelter Care, I probably at this point would have jumped off the Ferry Street Bridge, because at the age of 55, I did not qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. I was trying to get Social Security, didn't know where to go. Whitebird helped me to enter into the facility, who now I'm trying to become a productive citizen again. But I didn't qualify for senior or disabled because I wasn't old enough. I hadn't gotten my Social Security yet. I had no income. I was at a point where I couldn't work because of my condition. I have fought and gotten Social Security, but in that process, I do not qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. because I make too much money. Because of different onset dates of disability, I can't get Medicare until 08. If it weren't for patient assistance programs, I wouldn't have medications, nor could I afford the medications that I'm on that are letting me try to be a productive citizen. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that if it weren't for these community-based programs, I don't know where I would be right now, because I didn't fit anywhere. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's so meaningful to have those who have actually experienced the system. Now, where is White? What did you call it? White?
White Bird
is in
Eugene, Oregon.
Eugene. Okay, and you live in Eugene also?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Any questions? Thank you very much. This concludes our nonprofit community mental health providers, and let's run now into the Oregon Children's Intensive Treatment System, Aaron Kelly Seal and Mark McKechnie. And some of us are going to have to leave about 10 after, but how late will your side be able to stay?
We can stay until 10:30.
Until 10:30, okay.
Chairs Manas Anderson and Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm a social worker at the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland, and we're going to talk about integrated approaches to serving children with mental health needs this morning. And I beg your indulgence if I could excuse myself immediately after my portion. I have another appointment that I need to get to. Thank you. This has been a multi-year process for me. I'm a generalist as a social worker, and my work crosses several areas working for the Juvenile Rights Project. But if I become an expert on anything, it's how poorly our systems work together when it's most important that they do so. Juvenile Rights Project serves around 2,000 children a year who, by nature of our involvement with them, are also involved in juvenile court systems, schools, mental health, developmental disabilities. They run the gamut. And so I just want to highlight a few key issues that have led to the executive order being issued yesterday by Governor Kulongoski that we've worked with the governor's office to identify and to address. About a year ago, we brought together a group of parents and one youth who had experience working with multiple systems. And in your handouts, you have the synopsis of that focus group. A few things I wanted to highlight from that are that the vast majority of parents who have children served by Oregon Health Plan-funded mental health services who responded to a survey from the state said that their children required coordination of mental health services with one or two and up to five other systems. 80%, over 80%, needed some kind of coordination between their mental health services and at least one other public system. So this is a key issue and one that's very common. One of the things that parents who are struggling to care for their children said loud and clear is that they do not want, nor is it often helpful, have to turn to either the child welfare system or the justice system merely to gain access to additional services. It carries great stigma to become involved in those systems when it's unnecessary, and often, even then, the services that are available are still not appropriate and still do not meet their needs. Another message that the parents sent loud and clear is that they want to be able to care for their own children in their own homes, and they want the support to be able to do that rather than turning the care of their children over to others when it's not necessary. You heard about eligibility barriers for other populations. That's just as true for children. Hopefully the Healthy Kids Plan can take us a long way in in making sure access to basic services will be available for more children in the future, but eligibility for special education, eligibility for health care, eligibility for other kinds of services often stand in the way of families accessing the most basic services when they need them. And often it's only when the child's problems have become much, much more serious that they can finally gain access to services, yet those services tend to be much more expensive when they are finally available. So it's not a very cost-effective way to run a system to wait until children's symptoms become much, much worse before the family can access help. I also wanted to point out, in addition to the family focus group summary, there is a chart here that I put together to try to paint a picture of how much interplay and interrelatedness there are among different public systems. And it shows you the poor outcomes across many of these systems. And I know particularly for the child welfare population, there is this interplay between a child's home and family stability, between their school stability, and between the continuity of mental health services and the appropriate of mental health services. And when any piece of that puzzle is missing, it often causes a downward spiral for the child and for the family. I will end with just one very brief example from my professional experience before moving more into advocacy. I was a clinician, and when I was a therapist, I worked for a program. Fortunately, it was funded. That was a good thing. And it was for people who had no health coverage. So even though it was run somewhat on a shoestring, the advantage of serving people who are not on OHP or any other health coverage is that we didn't have to worry about what we were billing for or how much time we spent on a case, as long as we had the time to spend. So we could be more flexible and more creative as a result. And so I served a mother and her elementary school son, who often had these very extreme battles over the son doing his homework. And both the parent and the child had mental health issues. And these would become explosive arguments in the home. And I could have spent months upon months trying to do family therapy to sort of process the issues and help them come up with coping strategies and things like that. But instead, I was fortunate enough to be able to attend a meeting at the child's school, included the staff, and also DHS was involved. And we were able to present the problem and as a group come up with some kind of strategy. And as it turned out, the teacher stepped up and said, "Well, I'm here after school every day. He can stay and do his homework before he goes home." And it took that kind of flexibility, just getting the people in the room to come up with something. And this was basically a low to no cost strategy that turned out to be very effective to addressing one of the key challenges that this family faced. So that's the kind of flexibility that we're hoping can be built in on a much grander scale through this process that will be undertaken under the governor's executive order. And I thank you for your time, and we'll turn it over to Erin. And
thank you, Mr. McKinney.
Excuse myself.
Very much.
Chair Somi and Mona Sanderson, I'll be quick. I know you have to go, but I just wanted to say that today I think you all, for the record, I'm Erin Kelly Seal. I'm the Governor's Human Services Advisor, and I've had the privilege of working on issues relating to mental health and health care for the governor since 2003. And I think, you know, several themes have emerged today that also have played out these last several years, both when you talk about the adult system as well as the children's system of services for behavioral health needs. And those themes really are that people want to be productive and independent. And for children, those hopes are often expressed through their parents. Their parents would like them to be safe. They would like them to be successful at school, and they'd like them to be out of trouble. You've also, I think, heard the theme that people are served in communities best. It's best both for their own personal, mental, and physical health. It's also best for the payors of the and the providers, because it's the most cost-effective way to serve both adults and children. And I think you've also heard that there are challenges in the way that our systems are currently designed, both on the adult side and for children, when it comes to coordination across service systems. I think for children, some of those challenges are particularly acute, and several local communities really began looking at this issue more seriously. A few years ago, the legislature took up this charge in 2003 with a budget note to DHS, really targeting the mental health system and saying to it, you need to do better at serving people, at serving young people, children in communities and in their own homes and outside of those institutional settings that most people would actually prefer not to be in, particularly young people and children. And DHS did take that on. They learned several lessons in doing so, and I think Mark just did a great job of explaining that without the additional coordination, not just of the mental health system working better together to try and prioritize community-based treatment, but also for children, especially the education system, the child welfare system, the juvenile justice system, the developmentally the system serving people with developmental disabilities, all of those systems at the table working together is imperative for children with significant behavioral health needs to be successful. And so what you all started in 2003, the governor is, through this executive order that you all have a copy of, moving forward, I think, at the next level. And we've received commitment from the highest leadership in all of our state agencies, as well as from State Superintendent Susan Castillo, who was there yesterday at a roundtable discussion with young people and their families, who are, quite frankly, success stories, who told stories that were incredibly moving about what can happen when they do have the opportunity to be at home, to be in school, and to receive the kinds of services they need that build on their strengths and that really focus on them and their families' priorities, as opposed to focusing on the multiple systems and the siloed funding streams that currently support them. This order requires state agencies to come together, work together, figure out how to braid, blend, whatever you want to call it, the funding streams that we have so that we can maximize those, but also identify additional need, which I think we all know exists in that system. We plan to come back to you all late this fall, the steering committee will, with an implementation plan. And throughout the year after, the year following, I can anticipate that we will likely require some requests, be making some requests of our federal partners around some flexibility that we need to carry this out statewide. And we will also be making some requests of you all, both in terms of legislation and funding, with respect to how to continue to move forward, really what you all started. And I know every member of this committee is committed to, and I really just appreciate that commitment, and we welcome your participation. We have invited the Senate President and the Speaker of the House to each appoint a member to the steering committee that the Governor will be appointing this week, and welcome all of you to express any interest you may have in joining us in this very, very, very important discussion that we're about to have. So thank you very much.
And our thanks to you and the Governor for carrying the torch for all of these things. Thank you. Any questions? Jane Ellen. Now we know Jim and John, Jim Davis and John. Do you want to give yours, and then we'll let Jim and John
give theirs?
Jim and John.
Well, if you'd invited them up now, we would have had the three J's. But hello, Representative or Chair Tomei and Chair Mona Sanderson. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and members of the committee, thank you for sitting through these moving testimonies. My name is Jane Ellen Wydance, and I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and also am working a lot of my time this year on the Community Mental Health Coalition. This coalition, and you'll see as the documents are passed around to you, represents almost all of the community mental health providers, the hospital association, the community mental health directors. Everyone who works on mental health in Oregon has joined this coalition. And we've joined this coalition because we believe that we are on a precipice of an opportunity here to invest in community mental health.
We are in the process, and you will more than likely this session invest in the Oregon State Hospitals and build those new hospitals we need so desperately. But just like our Oregon State Hospital buildings are crumbling, our community mental health system is crumbling under the weight of the demand. We cannot continue to fund our and pay our staff. We cannot continue to pay for people to be in our hospitals. And we have no supportive services in many areas of our state to keep people from being incarcerated in our jails and prisons. We need your help. I'm here to beg you for that help today. We know that these community programs that you see before you and the proposal that we have in front of you will work. They are all research and evidence-based programs that have been proven effective here in Oregon and in other parts of the country. We know that we are asking you for a lot of money and a lot of investment. We believe that these investments will save us money in the long run. And more importantly, they will save human dignity and the quality of life of Oregonians with mental illness. And so we're before you today begging you for your help. Thank you.
And Ms. Widens, thank you so much for all of the coordination. We thank you and Laura Smith for coordinating this entire agenda for today. It was very well done, very well represented. Any questions?
And I also want to commend you for this paper, which lists the different programs and the amount of money that you're asking for. That gives us a snapshot of what you would like to have available to you and how it would be
what is needed.
Right. And I appreciate that.
And Chair Tomei, I'd like to point out that according to, and what we did is a coalition, we had come with a large proposal, very similar to what you see before you, but in bigger buckets. And when the Community Services Work Group issued their report, the coalition said, this makes so much sense, it's exactly what we are saying, it just provides better detail, and that's what you see before you today, is the coalition adopted the Community Services Work Group. And it is, as Senator Gordley mentioned, only a 25% investment in community mental health to meet the unmet needs that we have before us today. We think it's a starting point, and it's so sad to say that $116 million is a starting point, but that's where we're at today.
Thank you very much.
And I apologize for having to leave. So
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just want to say that I've been impressed with the Community Services Work Group report, and this is very helpful. You need to ask for what you need. My question and my pushback for the coalition would be discussion about revenue sources. Have you had them? Can you, you don't need to, I just want to put out some, it would be helpful for us to know what you're thinking if you've got some ideas. The other thing is prioritization of this list. To do this all could be unrealistic, but is there prioritization here? And my third question is, if this money dropped out of the sky tomorrow, I would doubt that we'd be able to ramp up immediately in all these areas. For example, I was thinking about the geriatric mental health specialist. I'm not sure we have that many geriatric mental health specialists in the States. Maybe we do. Do you have a sense of a phase-in for this and a prioritization if we were able to do additional resources? I would think the Ways and Means Committee people would be very interested in hearing your thoughts on those issues.
Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek, thank you for the questions. We have been challenged by many members to develop revenue sources for this. We were reluctant to do that and are, and to a certain degree, still reluctant just because of the fights that are entailed in developing revenue. The coalition hasn't come up with a position, though we would say that the money left over from the tobacco tax, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, are all ways of perhaps looking at investing this session and this biennium in those services, and we'll come back to you with a more fleshed out proposal on revenue later. You asked about a phased-in approach or prioritization. The coalition is wide-based, and we want to make sure that we meet the needs. And I think that you're right that there are services that we need to invest in immediately and as quickly as possible, and then services that we need to have time to develop. And we will be bringing that before Ways and Means as quickly as possible is what we think that phased-in approach could look like. And then the third thing was...
I think those are related. The phase-in versus prioritization.
Right.
Yeah. We believe that all of these things are critical. Oregon's mental health system has not received the attention and the funding it's needed for decades. And in the 2002 budget cuts, we made it even worse. We being the state of Oregon, and not just the legislature, but everybody has a responsibility in that. And it's now time that we look at this, with 18,000 people a year going into the criminal justice system because they're mentally ill, not because they just committed a crime. There's huge cost savings there, and human dignity is so critical in that component. The same thing with the inpatient psychiatric hospitals. We would rather not see people in crisis and deteriorating to the point where they have to stay 10 or 15 days in our hospitals. We want people to receive treatment and prevention services and the supports they need to maintain their dignity in the community, and then only if there is no other resources or if their condition is so bad to come into our hospitals. And if you look at it, I keep trying to come up with a drawing, and I'm not very good at drawing, but it's a circle where you have prevention and community supports, you have hospitalization, and then you have people coming back out into community supports and the services they need. And if you think of it in that way, it's really hard to prioritize. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to ask the final two witnesses to please come forward. And while they're coming, Representative Kotek, in partial response to your question about revenue, the Mental Health Caucus plans to have a conversation with Senators Morse, Schrader, Westland, and Deckert about a revenue proposal that they have been advocating for quite a while now. We'll have that conversation with them not this Thursday, but the following Thursday, and hope you can be on board for that. Gentlemen.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Bob Lawrence, who was here earlier from the Governor's Commission, asked me to testify on behalf of the work we did in Clackamas County. I'll be very brief this morning, but I wanted to provide a little bit of context about senior mental health. Back when the Older Americans Act was passed in 1965, the poverty rate among older people was about 30%. Elderly people were isolated and also low income. There was a raging discussion in gerontology communities about whether older people should be active or be disengaged from society. In a similar way, there was a debate in the mental health community about services to older people. In other words, would they live long enough to benefit from mental health services? And the other side of that stigma, would older people approach the mental health system? And times have changed dramatically. A person who was 60 in 1965 is now 102. We have different age cohorts that are coming forward that will need and demand services. In Clackamas County, we attempted to do a number of things to coordinate these services. We had to overcome the reluctance of our advisory council in those days, who didn't believe there was a need for senior mental health. This was in the early 1980s. When I became Area Agency on Aging Director, we were able to get the council to agree to fund a pilot that existed for many years that had three components to it. One of it was one-on-one services to clients. A second component was to have group sessions at senior centers. And a third was to do in-services with staff that were dealing with mental health issues every day as far as clients were concerned. I'm sorry to say that we had to defund that program as one of the final acts that I had to do before I retired. I retired because of the budget crisis that we were experiencing, the lack of federal and state dollars. But it is continuing to be a very much a pressing need for senior mental health. And I'll just end on crediting my colleague who's sitting next to me, Dr. James Davis, for his tireless efforts about bringing up the issue of senior mental health and why it's important. And I would just submit to you that the times have changed dramatically since the 1960s, and we have the demographic changes that you're all very much aware of, and we'll have a need for senior mental health like never before. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Yes, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors Coalition for Responsible Treatment, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. Hi, I'm a gerontologist and psychologist who's worked on both systems, the senior and disability as well as mental health systems, been fighting for senior mental health for over 30 years now. But today I wanted to just focus just very, very briefly on the very great need that exists in these communities. And then I provided you with some information on the projects, the senior mental health and addiction projects that I coordinated for a 12-year period until they were defunded in 2001 during the budget crisis at that point. I think many of you have heard, hopefully in great detail, the fact that seniors and people with disabilities have the highest rate of depression, anxiety, and other mental health problems, but yet they are completely ignored in the mental health system and addiction system, and it really is a travesty. If you look at their lives, you will see, in the case of seniors, more life adjustments than any other age group, everything from dealing with retirement to physical and emotional health problems to financial problems, you name it. And so their rate of depression is very, very high. People with disabilities are always dealing with, you know, their adjustments to those mobility problems and other physical frailties that they have. And their rate of depression is very, very high. And they carry a double stigma, but they're completely ignored. There's not, you can barely find anything about mental health and people with physical disabilities. The conservative estimates is that about a fifth or more of the senior population, and probably far more than that of the disability population, have mental health problems serious enough to need some kind of response. And yet in the community, and I wrote my dissertation on this, there's probably about 3.5% of the community mental health population are seniors. And that was, when I wrote my dissertation 26 years ago, it was the same figure, 3.5%. And a lot of the people are people who've been in the system who just happen to live longer. They're not really reaching out into the senior community and dealing with a lot of the problems that we're experiencing out in that community. And thus, and many legislators were quite shocked to hear the figure, thus, you know, you have about 25 to 30% of all suicides are seniors. And that's not a coincidence. We're not reaching out to deal with their mental health and addiction problems. And that is why the suicide rate is so high. And so some of the things that we were able to do, and I won't go into any detail, but you can see in the testimony that over a 12-year period, we were able to get a very small amount of money, $1 million, from the legislature to have community-based senior mental health and addiction projects. And you can see, as on page 3, that we had them in strategic locations around the state, and we funded geriatric mental health specialists, we did peer counseling programs, we did educational programs, we did outreach, and we were able to match that $1 million at about a 3-to-1 rate. We think it's closer to 4-to-1 rate. Older Americans Act monies, Medicare, Medicaid, all kinds of stuff we were able to throw into this little bit of matching funds. And we were able to make a tremendous impact, as you can see there, reaching thousands of seniors, reaching out to thousands of providers. And when we tested it, what we saw is that little bit of prevention helped people stay away from higher levels of care and probably save the state far, far more than they ever invested in this. So I guess in a final note, I would just like to ask the legislature to really, really commit this session to reaching out to these underserved populations. You have some good bills before you. 847 is a bill that would fund senior mental health projects around the state. We have a vehicle, 955, that we would be glad to just blend into that. We want to see more senior and disability mental health programs around the state. And then there's one other bill, 791, which puts together a task force on the mental health needs of the underserved populations. Our coalition that we put together not only deals with seniors and people with disabilities, but we also deal with ethnic minorities. All three of these populations have been completely ignored in the system, and so we have this camaraderie around mental health and addictions. And so we would like to see a task force put together that begins to look at these very serious mental health and addiction situations that haven't been looked at before. Last session, it was killed because DHS came in and said it would cost $160,000 to have this little task force that we want to put on. And we could have put on a statewide campaign for that much money. But this won't cost much. We just want to get together and we want to get the players together and really start looking at this very, very serious situation. And we want to see the state make a stronger commitment to these underserved populations. Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for adding that last piece in the last minute and a half of our discussion today. For me, and I believe I can say for Senator Carter as well, that has been the missing part of our discussion today. It's been a fine panel presentation overall, but that's been the missing
piece in our discussion, and I thank you very much for bringing it forward. And I would ask that in future presentations, so that future presentations are inclusive of all of Oregon's populations, that we have an explicit discussion, an explicit conversation about what it will take to also move those populations forward. That's been the missing piece. Thank you so much.
Good point, Senator. Thank you, gentlemen. Anyone? No, we don't have time for questions. Thank you so much. Thank you for the audience of people who came both to testify and to listen to the testimony today. And we hope that you all stay involved, and the next few months will be very important for the whole community. So thank you so much, and I will close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness.
And I will close the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs.